The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
People didn't write it, I'll say that, I don't think. I really don't want to accuse somebody because I might be accusing the wrong person. But I have a theory, but I will keep it under my hat.
In the summer of 1974, teenaged girls and young women began writing into local advice columnists and to Avon Cosmetics Incorporated, inquiring about a t-shirt that models in Avon ads wore, pushing their new line of cosmetics geared toward young women. Sweet honesty. At first, Avon told those who inquired that the shirts were only made in a small quantity, meant for the models only. But demand for them got so great, the company saw an opportunity and began selling the t-shirts to customers, largely through mail order. That fall, Avon Cosmetics mailed out hundreds, if not thousands, of them, much more than they were expecting. Within a year of the company's production of the t-shirts for the general public, in fact, Avon had to stop selling them altogether. They just couldn't keep up with the demand. Many folks who ordered a Sweet Honesty t-shirt never even got one by the time Avon began issuing refunds after they ceased production. 14-year-old Renee Wilson did get one. She was wearing it the last time she, 17-year-old Rachel Trelisa, and 9-year-old Julie Mosley were seen. If you haven't listened to part one, we urge you to do so before going any further into this episode. There are a few things following that likely won't make any sense if you haven't. Here's a brief summary, though, of what was covered last episode. The missing trio, as Julie, Renee, and Rachel became collectively known, disappeared either from Fort Worth's Seminary South Shopping Center or before they even got there, on December 23, 1974. Though Rachel Trelisa and her husband's 1972 Oldsmobile 98 was found in Sears Department Store's East parking lot, the car the girls were riding around in on their shopping trip, the last place they were undoubtedly seen was the Army-Navy Surplus and Discount Store near the mall. There, Renee Wilson finished paying off a couple pairs of hip-hugger jeans, one of which she changed into in the store's dressing room. Though Renee's parents and other family looked for them at Seminary South, they were nowhere to be found. Richard Wilson, Renee's father and his best friend, in fact, parked near a Sears Auto Center where they could keep an eye on Rachel's car that entire night. But Rachel, Renee, and Julie never came back, and no one else came near the Oldsmobile. The Fort Worth police refused to show up at the scene until every store at Seminary South was closed, which was 11 p.m., 7 hours after the Wilsons began their search. The girls would be back for Christmas, the cops told the families. They just took off for a while. That was far from Richard Wilson's worst experience with the Fort Worth police, and the family's displeasure and frustration with the department only mounted. But we'll get back to that later. That's the end of the summary. And warning, it's a bumpy ride from here. Missing persons reports were officially filed for all three of the girls at 1:30 a.m. on December 24th. The reports are standard. Renee Wilson was reported missing by phone by her mother Judy. The 14-year-old was wearing a pair of her new hip-hugger jeans, undoubtedly, thought to be purple, and red and white Oxford shoes. In the report, it lists Renee's shirt as a white pullover-style sweatshirt with Sweet Honesty emblazoned on the front in green letters. Avon only produced their Sweet Honesty tops as t-shirts, however, so this is a discrepancy, as is the color. Renee's Sweet Honesty t-shirt was light yellow, not white. The report states that she was last seen at noon on December 23, 1974, at her grandmother's house, where Rachel Trelisa picked her up. 9-year-old Julie Mosley's missing persons report states the same thing about her last known whereabouts and time, though no information about what she was wearing was given. Julie's report was filled out in person by her mother, Rayanne. Deborah Arnold, Rachel Trelisa's sister, reported the 17-year-old missing by telephone. Like in Julie's case, no description of the clothes she was wearing was given. Unlike both other girls' reports, however, Rachel was reported to be last seen at home, where she lived with her husband, Tommy, and her sister, at 12:30 p.m. that day. A clue, perhaps, that Tommy Trelisa's ex-wife Shayna's story about seeing all three girls at the Trelisa home when she picked up her and Tommy's 2-year-old boy, Sean, Rachel's stepson, might be true. Tommy, too, remembers that little Sean was to be picked up by his mother that day. A woman who said she worked at the nursery at Wedgwood Bowling Alley says she watched Sean while Tommy Trelisa bowled the evening Rachel, Renee, and Julie disappeared. It's hard to make sense out of that for a number of reasons. However, if she's simply mistaken about the date she watched Sean, if it were the night before the girls went missing, it not only gives more credence to Shauna's story, it also backs up another story about that night, at least in part. According to a private detective hired many years later, a witness said that on Sunday night, December 22nd, Tommy and Rachel bowled at the Wedgwood Bowling Alley, and little Sean was there, along with Rachel's sister, Deborah Arnold. This account is in contrast to Deborah's account of that evening, who said she worked in Dallas at Gino's nightclub that night. But nonetheless, it is another account of Tommy's son. This night will come up again, but not without first laying out context in the form of, frankly, the most controversial and argued aspect of Rachel, Renee, and Julie's disappearances, the infamous letter. On Tuesday, December 24th, 1974, the day following the disappearances of Renee Wilson, Julie Mosley, and Rachel Trelisa, a letter was found in the mailbox of Rachel and Tommy Trelisa's home on Minot Avenue. A private detective hired years later suggested that Deborah retrieved the letter in an envelope from the mailbox, but it's unclear who told him that. According to Tommy Trelisa and Rachel's sister Deborah Arnold, at least once publicly, Tommy retrieved the letter from the mailbox, and nothing accompanied it there, no bills, Christmas cards, or junk mail. Just a single envelope. Deborah said she watched Tommy walk out the front door to get the mail, but did not see him take it out of the box. When Tommy came back inside, opened up the envelope, and read the letter, Deborah said, a look of shock came over his face. As the story goes, Deborah immediately brought the letter to her parents, Francis and Cotton Arnold, upon learning what it said. "I know I'm going to catch it," the letter read, "but we just had to get away. We're going to Houston. See you in about a week. The car is in Sears' upper lot. Love, Rachel." The Fort Worth police, apparently, were already at the Arnold home when Deborah got there with the letter, presumably getting information about Rachel's disappearance. Deborah had brought the letter without the envelope it came in, and the cops asked her to go back to retrieve it. She drove back home, got the envelope, and gave it to police. The letter itself was written in ink, the writing appearing to be performed hurriedly. The envelope provided, however, was addressed in pencil to Thomas A. Trelisa, a seemingly formal way for Rachel to refer to her husband, who she always called Tommy. where the return address should have been, simply read Rachel. This envelope, at least, had indeed been mailed. The 10-cent stamp was canceled, and the cancellation would be the subject of controversy and speculation, since the copy was publicly seen. Now's as good a time as any to try to clear that up once and for all. The police commented right away that the envelope had been mailed from Fort Worth, but folks unfamiliar with postal cancellations at the time of the disappearance would later claim that the faded copy showed a cancellation zip code of 76083 with a backward 3, suggesting it was mailed from Eliasville or Throckmorton, Texas. Although there were, at the time, a few more towns that had that zip code is no longer in use. Others saw 76088, the second 8 faded or hadn't stamped properly, to look like a backwards 3, suggesting it'd been mailed from Weatherford. An incredible amount of time has been spent, discussions had, and heated, belligerent exchanges made regarding the envelope's zip code. The reality of the postmark, however, was neither those just mentioned or the others that have been speculated. Not even close. The police didn't determine at the time that the envelope had been mailed from Fort Worth to Fort Worth, just to hear themselves talk. Though the press, other news sources with seemingly endless resources to fact-check, and even a private investigator, believed that the envelope's origin was some great mystery, it isn't at all. A while back, we were presented with an email from Sherry McReynolds, who has investigated the disappearances of the missing trio exhaustively. The email had the envelope in question, along with multiple examples of others. Here's how it worked in 1974. The cancellation postmarks on each had 760. The 7 is code for Texas, the 6, Tarrant County, and the 0, Fort Worth. Looking straight on, those numbers are to the right and appear on the southeast side of the mark. Going the other direction, right side up, is 3B, which is code for a machine that processed the actual piece of mail, we were told by a gentleman who worked at the post office around the time Julie, Rachel, and Renee went missing. We were presented with other examples of this, such as 1A and 3A. The postmark on the envelope reads 76033B. This isn't just a theory, it's a verifiable fact. Perhaps one of the few this case has. The postal worker we spoke with, too, said that the envelope, which was postmarked the day it was found, December 24th, could have easily been put out to mail the day before when the girls disappeared, processed, and delivered in that time frame. Richard Wilson, Renee's father, in fact, has a theory on where the letter was mailed.
There was a little, I'd call it a little satellite post office there in Seminary South, but it was on the opposite end of where we were at, where the car was at. It was down closer to Boat Street, and we were closer to Seminary. Now, I figured that that's where it come from, but I don't know.
After all the families were told about the letter and were able to inspect it on December 24th, 1974, Christmas Eve, none of them seemed to buy it.
Rachel didn't write it, I'll say that, I don't think. She was left-handed, and that's, to me, that wasn't left-handed writing.
Rayanne Mosley, 9-year-old Julie's mother, told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that she didn't put much stock in it, and 14-year-old Renee's mother, Judy, said it didn't make sense. The families knew the girls didn't run off. Quotes by Rachel's husband, Tommy Trelisa, in 1974, seemed to suggest he was entertaining the idea that she wrote the note under coercion. But when we spoke with him recently, Tommy was adamant that he never believed Rachel wrote it. The day following the discovery, Christmas Day, 1974, in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the story of the letter broke. It was also the first article the newspaper published about the disappearances. In the article, police, quote, verified the letter had been written by Rachel, presumably after comparing her known handwriting to it.
It's her handwriting,
police juvenile officer Billy Wilbanks told the publication.
But I don't know if she was forced to write it.
There were several things that stuck out about the letter and the envelope beyond the different writing implements used for each. Whoever wrote it knew where Rachel and Tommy's 1972 Oldsmobile 98 was parked. When the letter was signed, whoever wrote it first misspelled Rachel, first penning E-E at the end of her name and correcting it to E-L. It seems like this alone would have caused police to be highly doubtful that Rachel actually wrote it. Still, in the following days, the Fort Worth police worked under the possibility that the letter was good and checked bus stations and other means the missing trio might have taken to travel to Houston, but there was no evidence anywhere that showed they did. The letter, ultimately, led the families and police nowhere. Decades after the disappearances, when a copy of the letter was leaked out for the public to see, speculations and theories were, and continue to be to this day, abundant. The Fort Worth police have always remained relatively tight-lipped concerning their thoughts and findings about the letter, but much of the work of the private detective hired by Rachel Trelease's brother, Rusty Arnold, who came on the case in the 1990s, has since made the rounds. The private eye, Dan James of Dan James Investigations, sent Detective Fortenberry of Fort Worth Police Department's Major Crimes Unit a 105-page document outlining his findings on the case, including, of course, the letter. According to James, Deborah retrieved the letter from the mailbox at 10 a.m. on December 24, 1974, the day after Julie, Renee, and Rachel went missing. Unfortunately, James assumed the letter was mailed from Eliasville. It, of course, was not. But it's James's other findings, anyway, that are most interesting. According to him, a couple who arrived earlier that morning from Austin to visit Tommy saw the letter taped to Rachel and Tommy's front door. Only the last sentence, "The car is in Sears upper lot," and "Love, Rachel," wasn't there. It instead read, "I know I'm going to catch it, but we just had to get away. We're going to Houston. See you in about a week." And that's it. I've reached out to the individuals Dan James claims reported this in more ways than one, but they did not reply. Dan James also agreed to speak with me on a couple occasions, but subsequently ghosted me. Anyway, James found this report relevant because Rachel's sister Deborah Arnold had a visitor in from Houston from December 22nd to either December 24th or 25th, he claims. Deborah, however, insists that this visitor actually didn't arrive until the day the letter was found, on the 24th, and left because she was too busy looking for her sister to host the man. James seems to be entertaining the idea that Deborah Arnold wrote the letter planning to ditch Christmas and accompany her visitor back to Houston. Something happened to the girls that she knew about or was involved in, and the letter got finished with the last sentence and "Love, Rachel" to throw the family and the cops off her scent. The private eye suggested a motive for the girls' disappearances. Rachel's husband, Tommy Trelease, James noted, had received a love letter from Deborah in November of 1974, the month prior. James claimed in his correspondence with Detective Fortenberry that this evidence was missing from the case file. Dan James, it should be noted, was allowed to look at least some of that file. However, the existence of such a letter isn't necessarily fact. And although James details an account of a fight between Rachel and Deborah the night before the missing trio disappeared, about Rachel's jealousy of Tommy's apparent infidelities with Deborah, that too can't be verified with public knowledge as anything other than rumor. The cause of the fight has also been reported to be about Tommy not wanting Rachel to go shopping the next day, which seems absurd. All he'd have to do is take the keys, or better yet, drive himself to work and leave Rachel with no car at all. It's difficult to believe that particular story whatsoever. Perhaps one of the major points of controversy over the Houston letter was the claim that it didn't fit in the envelope provided to police. While it's true that the copy of the letter that circulated years after the fact appears to only be folded once, and in a way that it couldn't possibly fit in the envelope, photos of the actual letter, at least to me, show two folds. I'm certainly not claiming this as fact, but I do not believe that anyone, aside from police, can make a factual claim about whether the letter fits in the envelope or not. I believe, too, that it would be careless and possibly even a complete waste of time to speculate any further on the folds. I just don't know, and I won't say either way unless the Fort Worth police do first, or I hold the letter in my hands myself, which, of course, isn't happening. Over the years, local law enforcement and even the FBI could never conclusively say who wrote that letter. If they ever figured anything out, they never publicly said so, at least not in any definite or specific way. This brings us then to the 2017 handwriting analysis. Wendy Carlson, a court-qualified forensic document examiner, whose expert testimony has been used in court cases in multiple U.S. states and beyond, compared a copy of the missing trio Houston letter and the envelope to several letters written by Tommy Tralisa. Using the quote, "Analyze, Compare, and Evaluate" method of examination, or ACE process, and examining not only handwriting, but also, quote, brainwriting, Carlson concluded, quote, "It is my professional expert opinion that the person who authored the Thomas A. Tralisa handwriting and signatures on the known documents was the same person who wrote the handwriting on the questioned documents." Meaning that Carlson believes, from analyzing the documents that include Tommy's handwriting, that he authored the Houston letter and the envelope in which it was claimed to have arrived in. "I am willing to testify in court to this fact in a court of law," Carlson closes the letter, "and I will provide exhibits to the court to show that my opinion is correct." Wendy Carlson's credentials are, to say the least, vast and impressive, but we'd be remiss to not bring up at least one case in which her analysis was found by a judge to be incorrect. The case was presented to a court in 2015 in Pennsylvania and concerned a will dispute. It was just a couple years before her examination of the letter in the missing trio case. Carlson's testimony was used in an attempt to show that the signature on a will was forged. The courts, however, determined that this was not the case. Judge Jed Rakoff called Carlson's opinion on the case, quote, "unreliable and inadmissible." The reasons for his conclusions are, possibly, relevant in the case of the missing trio Houston letter. The judge cited bias, that she knew the favored outcome even before the analysis. Expounding upon that, the judge says the subjectivity and vagueness of Carlson's analysis severely diminishes the reliability of Carlson's methodology. Because of time restraints, documents show, Carlson failed to use the last step in the ACE-V process in this case. The ACE, like in her analysis of the missing trio letter, was used, that's analyze, compare, and evaluate, but the V, which stands for verify, was not. Her analysis, Judge Rakoff concluded, was, quote, "critically flawed." Working with photocopies, too, can present problems with forensic document analysis. When working with anything but the original copy of a document, characteristics and features like indentations, outlines, feather strokes, pen stops, and alterations, among other things, can be lost. Again, Carlson used a photocopy of the missing trio letter. It should be noted that none of this is an attempt to discredit Wendy Carlson. Rather, it is an attempt at providing a fair report. Supposing Carlson is correct, and Tommy Trelisa did in fact write the letter and the envelope, it doesn't look good, but it certainly isn't proof that he was involved in the disappearances of his wife, Rachel Trelisa, Julie Mosley, and Renee Wilson. Some have entertained the notion that Tommy, or Tommy along with Deborah, created the letter in an attempt to quell the worry and fears of the families, or that Tommy wrote it to get the car back quickly. None of these theories, that we are aware of or can find evidence of, are anything more than sheer speculation. As far as the EE corrected to EL in the letter's closing, Love, Rachel, a friend brought to our attention that they've made similar mistakes while signing their name in a hurry, and at least one other individual they spoke with had done the same, many times. Both Erica and I can remember making similar mistakes, as can several other friends we spoke with. We have and offer no opinion who wrote the letter discovered on December 24, 1974. Even before Wendy Carlson provided an analysis of a photocopy of the letter, folks in internet discussion groups and social media were making their own comparisons after tracking down samples of Tommy Trelisa's handwriting. It's safe to say the Fort Worth police know much more about the letter than the public, or have at least been able to come up with an educated theory on who wrote it and why. Anyway, there's another story about the day Rachel, Renee, and Julie went missing, too. During the time of the disappearances, Cotton Arnold, Rachel Trelisa's father, was fighting cancer. Some sources say that Cotton had treatment in Houston that day, and Fran Arnold drove him there, leaving Tommy's whereabouts unaccounted for. From what we've been able to surmise, though, Francis Arnold accounted for Tommy having been at the shop that day, at least at first. It's difficult to imagine why Francis would have done this if she didn't know for a fact that Tommy was at Arnold Transmission Service that day. If the Fort Worth police weren't all over Tommy near the beginning, they certainly weren't doing their job. I can only assume they were. Tommy Trelisa told us he was polygraphed twice and said the accusations that have followed him all these years have made his life hard.
I took a lie detector test, you know, polygraph and everything, and I don't know who else did. Actually, I volunteered. I said, I'll take a polygraph, you know, want me to, and I took a polygraph. You know, but I know the police were looking for, and of course I look for. It just affected me in ways that I can't really talk about. You know, very painful. Very painful.
Back in 1974, Christmas at the Mosleys, the Wilsons, the Arnolds, and the Trelisas was somber, if not insufferable. Gifts for the missing girls remained unopened, and festivities had, of course, been abandoned for the continuing search. Calls flooded into the girls' homes. Most were of concern, and those that offered up tips and information, anyway, didn't lead anywhere. After days with no sign of the girls, on Sunday, December 29th, Judy Wilson released a statement in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Speaking directly to the girls and perhaps grasping onto a thread of hope because of the mysterious letter, she said that none of the families, quote, believe that you have voluntarily run away, but if you have, we beg you to come home immediately or telephone so someone can come after you. We are still behind you 100%. And there is nothing we will not do for you. Should some unknown individual be holding the girls against their will, Mrs. Wilson also begged for their release, saying, quote, so that they may be reunited with their loved ones. Tommy Trelisa told the newspaper that he was at the point of a nervous breakdown, waiting for news about his wife. The next day, Monday, December 30th, 1974, exactly a week after Julie Mosley, Rachel Trelisa, and Renee Wilson went missing, the families met up at the Fort Worth Greyhound bus station in hopes that the trio would come strolling off one of the buses coming in from Houston. Here's Richard Wilson on that.
And then when we got the letter that said they'd be back in about a week. When the week was up, me, Judy, Francis, Rayanne, and some reporter, and Tommy, we all went down to the Greyhound bus station and sat down there and waited on a couple of buses to come in. And there was one coming in a lot later. Me and Tommy stayed down there and waited on it, too. The rest of the family went home.
As days turned to weeks, the families became frustrated with the lack of progress being made in the investigation. A reward was established, and it brought in some tips, but none seemed to lead police anywhere. In fact, a juvenile officer working the case commented in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that the twists and turns they'd followed all came back to the same place, the place they'd started, Rachel's Oldsmobile 98 in the Seminary South parking lot. They'd gone from, quote, nowhere back to nowhere. The letter certainly didn't help, and only served to confuse what really happened to Julie, Renee, and Rachel. But it was far from the only thing that further muddied the already murky waters. We'll pick up from here in just a few days, releasing the next episode of Gone Cold earlier than our usual weekly schedule. If you have any information about the disappearances of Mary Rachel Trelisa, Lisa Renee Wilson, or Julianne Mosley, please contact the Fort Worth Police Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. There are a ton of folks who've helped us along the way, and we'd like to thank them. Kelly Arnold, Sherry McReynolds, Kim Cadell, Judy Burns, Jana Roberts, Jackie Jones, Linda Trelisa, Wanda McCaslin, PJ Stewart, Mary Kay, Kim, Diane, Kathy, and so many others. Special thanks to those who contributed directly to this episode, Richard Wilson and Thomas Trelisa. If you'd like to help find answers for the families of unsolved crime victims from all over, or help identify a Jane or John Doe, please visit DNASolves.com, where you can submit your DNA data from a consumer testing company like Ancestry or 23andMe to their database. We'll provide a link in the show notes. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as The Slayer Saint, about little-known serial killer Tommy Ray Neelan, among others. Thanks to everyone who supports us there, it means the world to us. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the Dallas Morning News, Private Investigator Dan James's email to Detective Fortenberry of the Fort Worth Police, and Fran Arnold's notes were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.